Ukrainian tractor hackers today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Many U.S. farmers use high-tech John Deere tractors, but if there's a software malfunction during planting time...
And it can be something as small as a sensor in the seat that will shut it down at times. I can't keep planting.
And that's where the Ukrainian hackers come in. Plus, some Chinese Americans say Maryland shouldn't become a sanctuary state.
I follow the rule of law. I follow everything. But now they try to pass this law. They said, oh, it doesn't matter anymore.
And a presidential power grab in Venezuela.
Right now, more people than ever are saying this really is the definitive step to an autocratic regime.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. It's Friday. Glad to have you along for the ride today. We start with a question that may sound deeply philosophical, but it's got serious practical implications for people all over the country. When is a sanctuary city not a sanctuary city? American cities and states have been grappling with how to respond to President Trump's hardline stance on immigration. In some places, local officials really want all residents to feel like they can turn to the local police, regardless of their immigration status. But officials are afraid of losing federal funding. Attorney General Jeff Sessions threatened as much this week. So some cities have decided to walk a fine line. In Arizona, the city of Tucson says it's not a sanctuary city. Instead, it's an immigrant-friendly city. Regina Romero is the vice mayor there. Regina, explain, if you would, what being an immigrant-friendly city means exactly.
It has most of the items that a sanctuary city has. And my intent, since I've been on the council for the last 9 years, has been to protect every resident of Tucson, no matter of status.
Does Tucson detain undocumented immigrants if asked by ICE?
No. We, the mayor and council, have given very express direction to the Tucson Police Department to interact as less as they can with Customs and Border Protection.
So just to be clear, Tucson is an immigrant-friendly city, offers sanctuary to its residents, documented and undocumented, correct?
Yes.
But apparently there were officials in Tucson who supported immigrant-friendly but not sanctuary city. So what teeth were taken out of sanctuary city that made it palatable to officials as an immigrant-friendly city?
I think it's a word. You know, it's a word. A word is a word is a word.
Yeah, but I'm not sure it is a word. I mean, then why didn't you call yourself sanctuary city?
I think that cities throughout this country, especially cities like ours that is a very democratic city in a red state, it seems as though using that word creates a target. And to be honest with you, I feel as though cities throughout the country, mayors and councils throughout the country, some of them don't want to use the word because of creating that target.
What everyone in sanctuary cities seems to be really concerned about is what happens when push truly comes to shove. Like, is any sanctuary city or immigrant-friendly city really ready to lose federal funds or face perhaps the National Guard if Trump is determined to take his policy to the hilt?
Well, those are two different questions. The first one, ready to lose federal funds? Of course not. And to be honest with you, the Supreme Court has found the 10th Amendment to mean that the federal government cannot coerce or force states and cities to do the federal enforcement work. What that means is that the federal government, the Trump administration, cannot come to Tucson and say, we deem you a sanctuary city and we will take your community development block grants away. Why? Because the city of Tucson never signed on any dotted line that says, we'll take your community development block grants and do your federal immigration enforcement work. So we can take the Trump administration to court. Threats and coercion and bullying does not equal law.
Finally, Regina Romero, how do you feel your role as vice mayor of Tucson has changed since the election in November?
Well, I think that I'm very prepared to resist the bullying that we see happening coming from the Trump administration. I also work with the Center for Biological Diversity, and I see the dismantling of environmental protections and laws. I see the dismantling of programs that, like Meals on Wheels, that feed seniors in our country. It is about taking a stance, and I will continue to do everything that I can to represent the residents of Tucson, but also the values of this country, and to stand for what's right.
Regina Romero is the vice mayor of Tucson. Thank you for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Marco. I really appreciate your time.
The debate over sanctuary cities and states is going on all over the country. In Maryland, one immigrant community that doesn't usually wade into politics is taking a stand and is coming out loudly against sanctuary. Rhoda Metcalf tells us more.
The people who spoke up at the hearing came as quite a surprise.
This will definitely allow illegal criminal elements to take advantage of the situation.
Recently, 27 Chinese Americans showed up at a hearing in Annapolis to testify against a bill that would make Maryland a so-called sanctuary state. It would, among other things, prohibit jails from holding people for immigration reasons unless there's a warrant.
Zhenya Li, to be followed by Sheng Tu. Welcome.
The same group showed up in the town of Rockville, Maryland as well, speaking against another sanctuary proposal there.
If you let this proposal pass, you indeed are telling the world this country is only a jungle without respect the immigration laws.
The group calls themselves the Maryland Chinese American Network. They know each other through a parents association. Chen Tu is their main organizer. I meet him at an outdoor cafe where he explains that most in the group had never spoken publicly before. But these sanctuary laws got them angry, Tu says, in part because they came here as legal immigrants.
It gives people a sense that, oh, I follow the rule of law. I follow everything. But now they try to pass this law. They said, oh, it doesn't matter anymore.
Like most in his group, Tu came to the U.S. in the 90s as a grad student. He stayed for an engineering job and now owns a consulting firm. Tu says one of his group's greatest fears is that sanctuary laws will attract criminal immigrants. Those fears were stoked even more this month after two undocumented immigrants were charged with the alleged rape of a Maryland high school student. But the Chinese American group's harsh comments about immigrants don't sit well with some Asian Americans.
I'm kind of startled. Just listening to the testimony, you would think that we were in the midst of some major crime wave.
Debbie Chen, who came to the U.S. from Taiwan when she was two, brought statistics to a hearing that show crime levels have dropped in parts of Maryland with sanctuary policies. A few days later at a restaurant, Chen says she decided to speak at the hearing when she realized the opposition group would be there.
To show that there were other Asian Americans, Chinese Americans, who were for the bill.
Jim Huan says he also got angry during one of the public forums. His parents came here in the 90s as students, just like those in the group opposing sanctuary. Chinese students got special treatment at that time, he says. After the deadly Tiananmen Square protests, the U.S. made it easy for many of them to stay in the U.S. and work.
And to have the same people then come out and say that a proposed law is providing special privileges to other people who didn't start with the same privileges that they had was really enraging.
But Chen Tu says not everyone in his group benefited from that special treatment. He also thinks the undocumented people should have a path to citizenship. But sanctuary, he says, just undermines the rule of law.
We know how lawlessness can bring down a country. Cultural Revolution, 20 million people died because there's no law. Just Chairman Mao said something and then people die. The rule of law, we don't want that to be weakened.
Some Republicans, meanwhile, are delighted to see the Chinese American group oppose the sanctuary laws. A Maryland Republican committee is featuring a picture of the group on its webpage. But for Tu, what's more important is that his community is taking a stand in local politics for the first time.
So we're very proud that we did this. We are Americans, and we're going to use our civic duty very well from now on.
For The World, Rhoda Metcalf, Montgomery County, Maryland.
We've become used to hearing astonishing stories out of Venezuela about severe shortages, food, fuel, even diapers. This is an oil-rich country where people can't get enough to eat now. But the story today is about a full-blown political crisis in the country. This week, Venezuela's Supreme Court seized the power of the legislature. Opposition leaders there are calling it a coup. Hannah Dreyer is with the Associated Press in Caracas. So what exactly happened, Hannah?
The Congress here is the one branch of power that isn't in the hands of President Nicolas Maduro and the Socialist Administration. And really, for a year, Maduro has been kind of ruling by decree and ignoring Congress. But yesterday, the Supreme Court said that it was just taking over all the role that Congress was serving before.
So if people are calling this a coup, it's a coup by the Supreme Court on behalf of Maduro?
Right. They're calling it what people in Latin America call a self-coup. And that kind of refers back to Fujimori and the dark days where there was a lot of dictatorship. Now it's a pretty democratic region, and people are saying that this is the first coup in recent memory.
Does Maduro see the legislature as filled with political opponents who threaten his own livelihood?
The legislature is filled with political opponents. It's controlled by the opposition. They won it in a landslide back in 2015, and they've been saying that they want to get Maduro out of power. And Maduro's response has been to basically take away all the responsibilities of Congress little by little until yesterday. They were just a body that couldn't do anything. And now I guess they're not a body at all down here.
So what can Maduro's opponents do now to fight back? What recourse do they have?
That is a good question. I mean, their main strategy was to try to get him through legislation, and they can't legislate anymore. So they're calling for protests. As soon as it was light this morning, people were out in the streets protesting. But the secret police and the regular police were out in force, and they cracked down on those protests.
So it sounds like this could be the beginning of a Nicolas Maduro dictatorship, or it could suggest that he's totally embattled and might be about to fall. Which one is it?
Right. That's always the question. Are we already in a dictatorship? Is this just a flawed democracy or a managed democracy? But right now, more people than ever are saying this really is the definitive step to an autocratic regime. And there's more pressure from abroad than we've seen before. We have a couple countries, Peru, Colombia, recalling their ambassadors. And I've seen some hardliners calling for the Marines to invade. Wow. People are getting desperate.
Like the U.S. Marines.
Right. People have started asking me that, too. When they see me or hear my gringo accent, they'll say, one of the Marines coming. I mean, joking, but right. It's on people's minds.
So as people in Caracas are starving, how does this kind of specter of autocracy sit with them right now?
You'd think that with something as dramatic as ending a branch of power, the streets would be filled with protesters. But people today are mostly just trying to get through the day. They're waiting in food lines. They're trying to find clean water. So people are talking about the fact that this huge political story is unfolding, but they're still focused on the drama of their day-to-day lives.
Right. Well, as you are, I saw a tweet you posted not so long ago. You had been away, and upon your return, you noticed the shocking appearance of some workers in your building.
That's right. The person who does maintenance in my building and the concierge who lives on the ground floor and helps us all out have both lost a huge amount of weight. They look like they have a wasting disease. But living here, you don't notice it as much. So I realized when I came back from this trip that the people all around me are going hungry. But you see people day to day, and it's just such a part of the fabric of life here that unless you go somewhere like the U.S. and then come back and it hits you, you just kind of get used to it.
A dismal fabric of life, for sure. Hannah Dreyer with the Associated Press in Caracas. Thank you, as always.
Thanks, Marco.
Why farmers in Nebraska are saying, please hack my tractor. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Let's say I want to buy a tractor. Not completely incomprehensible. I once went with a friend who was buying one. So anyway, let's say I buy a John Deere tractor. Do I own that tractor? Maybe not all of it. The software on that tractor technically belongs to John Deere, like the software on my phone, only my phone isn't responsible for getting the crops in and keeping me in business. That's why farmers in Nebraska and around the country are fighting with John Deere and other large tractor manufacturers. The farmers want the right to fix their own equipment, which has become very high-tech and very expensive. Specifically, they want access to the software to work on the tractors themselves. The manufacturers say no. So American farmers have turned to Eastern European hackers to access pirated software on the black market. Jason Kebler broke the story for Vice Media's tech site, Motherboard.
For the last 100 years or so, farmers have been very used to being able to fix their tractor. If the transmission broke, they've just been able to fix it. But in recent years, John Deere has been introducing what's known as software locks that prevent the replacement of parts, except for by a John Deere dealer.
That suggests that the whole tractor business has gotten super high tech.
It has, yeah. They're basically like moving cell phones at this point. The latest model tractors get updates like your cell phone or your computer would. The software updates are done remotely by John Deere.
Except these tractors cost upwards around $300,000, and I don't know any cell phones that do. So we spoke with one Nebraska farmer, Kyle Schwarting. Let's hear from him.
Basically, we can't communicate with the electronics on a tractor anymore. If the tractor breaks down, I can't keep planting. And the problem that I have is if I can't get the dealership to come out and hook their machine up to it, diagnose what's wrong for me, I'm not going to be able to keep going.
So Schwarting says it's too expensive and costly and sometimes really far away to get to a repair place, a dealer. How much are these farmers in debt, as it were, to John Deere or any of these other manufacturers?
They're very used to fixing things themselves, and now they have to wait for a John Deere dealer to come out there and authorize the repair. That costs $230 plus $130 an hour. And from what I've heard, that usually consists of someone plugging a USB port into the tractor and hitting a button.
Right, and that's what we've heard from Kyle Schwarting.
For 75 miles, they charge $2 or $3 a mile just to drive out, plus a minimum service call. To come out and fix a $50 part could cost me $2,000. And if it's worse than that or they can't come out, then I have to hire a semi to load my tractor up, haul it to them, have them hook it up. And by the time I'm done with all of this, I mean, I could have a lot of money into it.
So, Jason Kebler, what are these farmers doing instead?
Yeah, so there's actually this underground market of tractor repair pirates, essentially. And so what they're doing is they're getting the software that John Deere uses to authorize these repairs. They're sending it to hackers in Ukraine or Eastern Europe, and they're hacking it, sending it back and installing it on the tractors themselves, which allows them to repair whatever they want, just as they've always done.
Yeah, and it's not just John Deere. It's all tractor manufacturers are affected by this, those who have the software. Kyle Schwarting, our farmer in Nebraska, says pretty much everybody he knows is using this hack software.
You're talking about the Russian software? Yeah, if you want to buy it from them or China or whoever it comes from, you're going to do whatever you got to do to get your tractor fixed if you have to. Every field's worth $100,000. You just can't afford to not get it done. You can't afford to not do it. So most every farmer that's doing this has somebody that can help them out if they get into a bad spot.
Jason Kebler, what's the industry said about this whole thing?
John Deere and other manufacturers really don't want this to happen because it's obviously become a big part of their business. There's this ongoing battle in 8 states where legislators are considering what's known as right to repair laws. And what these would do would be make it legal to repair your tractor or your cell phone or your air conditioner. And it would also require companies like John Deere to make that software available on the open market.
So if you're a company like John Deere and you're looking at this legislation potentially happening in 8 states, including Nebraska, what are you thinking right now?
They've fought it really hard in every state. And it's not just John Deere. It's also Apple. It's IBM. It's all these trade organizations that include cell phone carriers, heater repair people, microwave manufacturers, the toy industry. It's basically this big group of manufacturers against a small group of farmers, cell phone repair people, and independent service professionals.
So I gather there's also a movement in the EU. Could this be a game changer?
So we've actually seen this battle before with car manufacturers. And in 2012, there was a law passed in Massachusetts that required car manufacturers to sell parts and to not put these software locks on their cars. And what happened is that essentially became a de facto national law because the car manufacturers didn't want to have to deal with 50 different laws in different states. And so I think if this goes through in a couple states or maybe a couple countries, we could see a huge opening of the repair market.
Yeah. In the meantime, the software, not to mention the hack software, it's business. It's big business, right?
It's huge business. Yeah. I mean, I've heard from people who do repairs in Virginia, South Carolina, and the whole mid-Atlantic. So if you know someone who has the ability to repair the tractor, they become the go-to person.
And that's Ukrainian or other hack software.
I've heard that it generally comes from Eastern Europe. I spoke to a farmer in North Carolina who says he flies out to Ukraine 6 or 7 times a year just to talk to the hackers, make sure they're happy. He actually exports tractors out there as well. So yeah, it's become this international business.
Jason Kebler with the tech site Motherboard. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We called up Chuck Studer, Director of Industry Relations for John Deere, and asked what he thought of the farmers' complaints about restricted access to the repair software for their tractors.
There's certainly been a lot of statements here recently that have maybe taken isolated situations and tried to portray them as commonplace, but very few repairs require software. Very few repairs require diagnostic software from that standpoint. So let me assure you and your listeners that John Deere and John Deere dealers understand the relationship that we've had with our customers over 180 years is all dependent upon keeping those machines operating in the field. On those rare occasions when software might be needed, our dealers are well equipped and they try to prioritize those repairs to keep machines up and running in the field.
So if that's been the philosophy of John Deere for 180 years, why then require consumers to sign an end-user license agreement, which actually forbids them from working with the software to fix their own machines?
Well, Marco, I think license agreements are part of our everyday life. I'm sure the phone that you use, there was a license agreement associated with that. And in many ways, license agreements are there to protect both parties. I think if you take the time to really read our license agreement, you'll understand that in many ways, it supports a customer's right to repair. But there's really no need for a customer to go out and look for third-party hardware when they can get the original version of that embedded code from John Deere at really a very minimal cost. There is no need to modify or reverse engineer or hack that original embedded code.
Why limit access to any of the software?
Well, we look at that embedded code as part of our intellectual property. We look at it as what's creating value that the customers are demanding today. And we look at that no differently than we may look at the design of our pistons in our engines or et cetera. It's something of value to Deere, and it's something that's important for our customers that we continue to ensure the type of experience that they've come to expect from John Deere.
Chuck Studer, Director of Industry Relations for John Deere. Thanks very much for your time.
I appreciate the opportunity to visit.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump likes to say the American dream has moved to Mexico, but this economist would like Trump to see how most Mexican workers really live.
The conditions of these people are nothing close to the American dream. The American dream just disappeared for everybody. It didn't come to Mexico.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This was the week that we knew for sure that Brexit is going to happen because the UK officially set the proceedings in motion on Tuesday. But no one really knows for sure what the impact of leaving the EU will be. We want to focus on the financial services industry, banks and investment houses, which are headquartered in London. There's concern they could take a big hit, and it looks like France is capitalizing on the uncertainty. The group Paris Europlace represents French business and finance, and it's holding roadshows in Boston and New York in May, aimed at persuading American finance companies to choose Paris, not London, as their European base. Arnaud de Bresson is managing director of Paris Europlace. The thing is that France has this reputation for its bureaucracy and thick red tape when it comes to business. How concerned are you that that might deter the U.S. from doing more business in France?
I think the image, this image is a little bit from the past. We believe there is a gap today between the perception of France and the reality. But let's say since 10 years now, France has doing much reforms and a move. And we fighting for that, and we are more than convinced that the reforms will accelerate with the next government, which will come from the next elections. We are in the process to become a much more business-friendly country, and things have already much changed concretely in the reality, more especially in the financial marketplace.
So what are these roadshows planned for Boston and New York in May all about? Why those cities? And what kind of pitch can American financiers expect from their French counterparts?
Paris today has three major cards in the context of the Brexit to attract international houses and companies, financial companies, which want to make business in Paris. First card is the fact that Paris is the only other global city in Europe, very comparable to London because of the size of the GDP, because of the size of the employment, the presence of high-level skills. Second card is the fact that Paris is number one financial center in continental Europe, even bigger than Frankfurt. When I ask U.S. banks, what difference do you see between Paris and Frankfurt? The answer is, in Paris, we have our clients, big corporates, French and international, and active market players. When in Frankfurt, we have more the German banks and our competitors, and Paris is very near from London in terms of capital market culture. And third, French tech, the development of young, innovative startups, including in the financial sector with a fintech. And Paris is very near London in terms of the acceleration of the development of fintech and young companies.
So what is your hope, like in 2 years, that banks and investment firms will have been settled into offices in La Défense and along the Champs-Élysées?
It's not a hope. We believe today that all major U.S. and international fund managers and banks are considering the way to rebalance part of their activities. And we have made a job to examine what sectors will be impacted, what type of activities, what type of jobs, in fact, investment banking, asset management, but also insurance, private equity, fintech, all these sectors will be impacted. And we are in a connection. We have developed many contacts in London, in New York, in Tokyo, in China, with these international banks. And we see today that many of them are considering with much interest the fact that the real capital market center in the European Union will be Paris.
Arnaud de Bresson, Managing Director of Paris, Your Place. Thank you very much.
Thank you to you.
When it comes to trade with Mexico, the U.S. is in a deep hole. We imported $63 billion more stuff than we sold there last year. President Trump blames NAFTA for this trade imbalance. He's labeled it the worst trade deal maybe ever. And he's calling for a 90-day review of what he says are abusive trade practices. Of course, Trump wants to renegotiate the trade deal to make things better for the U.S. But what could Mexico get out of a revised deal? Potentially a lot. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
When President Trump talks about Mexico ripping off the U.S., and he brings it up a lot, people like Fernando Turner can't believe what they're hearing.
We appreciate his tremendous confidence in Mexicans' ability to cheat U.S. people, no? But that's totally the contrary. History tells you that has been the other way, you know?
Turner is the Secretary of Economic Development and Labor for the northern Mexican state of Nuevo León, a state with many U.S.-based multinationals. Its capital, Monterrey, has become one of Latin America's wealthiest cities. But just because American companies like General Electric and Ford have factories in the area, that doesn't mean the average Mexican is getting rich.
When you look at the type of jobs that are created because of the maquila industry, meaning manufacturing industry in Mexico, those are very poor jobs.
That's Vera Diana Rios, a political scientist based in Mexico City. Many Mexican factory workers earn just $2 to $3 an hour. And Rios says that's locking Mexicans into a cycle of poverty.
Many of the daughters and the sons of the maquiladora workers end up in crime, end up doing drugs, end up being part of the cartels, because the jobs that their father has and their mother have give them no time to provide vigilance, education, give them no money for put the kids in good schools.
Now, that's one perspective. Here are some others. Investment coming from U.S. corporations has hugely benefited Mexico on the whole. And NAFTA created many manufacturing jobs that do pay better than most agricultural work. Rios concedes these points, but says those reasons aren't enough.
The only reason why Mexico and Mexicans are in favor of NAFTA is because they are not ambitious enough. It's because they believe that the trade-off is between being unemployed or being employed in these very poor industries.
This idea, acting more ambitious, is catching on. More and more Mexican politicians are saying if President Trump wants to hash out a new trade deal, fine, let's do it. Fernando Turner says there are a lot of ways for an updated NAFTA to help Mexico. Consider agriculture.
The United States government subsidized substantially the agriculture. So in a way, the Mexican growers are not competing in equal circumstances with the U.S. growers because they don't have the subsidy that the United States has. That's why we import 75% of the grains.
Because U.S. farmers get more help from the U.S. government, U.S. corn is cheap. As a result, Mexicans buy about $2.5 billion worth of it from the U.S. each year. And Mexico is a country where children learn the expression, sin maíz, no hay país. Without corn, there is no country. Timothy A. Wise with the Small Planet Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, has researched Mexican corn farmers. He says Mexican farms need to regain their self-sufficiency and become exporters. And that can begin by renegotiating NAFTA.
To go to the table with something to demand more protection for its corn farmers. We don't want all your corn just flooding in. And we want to stimulate rural development from the bottom up by investing in small-scale corn farmers.
Then there's transportation. Mexican truckers want greater access to American highways. Right now, most cargo coming from Mexico is unloaded, then reloaded onto American trucks at the border. The U.S. trucking industry has long argued that Mexican trucks and drivers aren't safe enough for American roads. Mexicans naturally see things differently. Business leaders from both countries argue that opening highways to Mexican trucks could lower transportation costs. Timothy A. Wise would also like to see a revamped NAFTA include more labor and environmental protections south of the border.
Mexico, it needs to put Mexico first in exactly the ways Trump wants to put America first.
But Wise isn't optimistic. He thinks Trump's priorities in renegotiating NAFTA are to pry open more markets for U.S. exports and to bully Mexico into making more concessions. Vera Diana Rios would like President Trump to stop saying Mexico stole American jobs and to come to Mexico and see the reality.
Because you would see that the conditions of these people are nothing close to the American dream. The American dream just disappeared for everybody. It didn't come to Mexico.
But that's not Trump's narrative. He's taken to saying the American dream is back. And when he says it, he just means in America. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Another of President Trump's campaign promises is building that wall to keep people from crossing illegally from Mexico into the U.S. And the bidding process is underway. But there was a time when Americans were going in the opposite direction, fleeing over the border into Mexico. I'm talking about the Underground Railroad, the one thousands of slaves took south to freedom. We usually think of the Underground Railroad as an escape route to the Union in the north, but that path also went to Mexico.
I would say 4,000 to 5,000 of them fled in this region. Could have been any time between 1830 and 1865.
That's Roseanne Bachagarza, who teaches at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. I asked her why escaped slaves opted for that path instead of coming north.
A lot of these slaves that left the country were already in Texas working on plantations or perhaps even Louisiana or other bordering states. So it was closer. And some of them had experience riding and driving ox carts full of cotton from their master's plantation in East Texas, for example, going down to Brownsville to the port to trade into Mexico. So they already knew the land, they knew the terrain, they knew how to get there. So it was natural they decided to take a chance and move on over the border for freedom.
Did American families in this area offer any support or refuge before getting to Mexico?
I've been doing some particular research on some mixed-race families that had come to the region to settle in the 1850s. These families came with emancipated slaves, and they made a few settlements along the river on the north side. I imagine that they were assisting escaped slaves to go across the river through ferry landings and other ways. One particular story, a former slave, Sally Rowe, had talked about a story of her father crossing the Rio Grande on a bale of cotton. I called a local cotton ginner to repeat the story to him and ask him his opinion, and he said, absolutely not. It would sink right to the bottom. That particular story was probably a little bit embellished to make it interesting, I suppose.
Were there slave hunters who tracked these runaway slaves across the border back then?
Oh, yes. Several of them, but two in particular that I've been researching. John Ford, he rose to the rank of colonel in the Confederate Army. And then Colonel Santos Benavides, the highest ranking Tejano soldier in the Confederacy out of Laredo, was also tracking slaves. And both were skilled horsemen. John Ford in particular traversed the Nueces Strip, which is a 150-mile expanse between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande River. It's very desolate, very dry, you know, not a lot of water, subject to Indian attacks and things like that. So these two gentlemen in particular, very familiar with the area, were motivated by a $600 per slave caught bounty. They wanted to catch the ones that were escaping over the border to apprehend them and return them to their owners.
I have read that the Texas statewide law enforcement agency, the Texas Rangers, have roots in this whole period. Is that right?
Yeah, John Ford was a Texas Ranger. They were also looking for escaped slaves to capture and return to their owners.
So, Roseanne, I'm curious to know what parallels you see today between slaves in search of freedom in the 1850s going south and Mexicans and other nationalities trying to find a better life and ending up perhaps free but still not thriving.
At least they were happy to be free. When they went over into Mexico, they appeared to be welcomed with open arms. They were able to earn some money. And what they did was they worked there long enough to save some money and go back over the border once the Civil War was over, once slaves were freed in the United States. And in some cases, you know, they referred to their fathers as their pappy, and that he came back over the border and brought me a new dress or something, some kind of gift or item of purchase, which never would have happened if they were enslaved on a plantation. They also learned how to speak Spanish. So they assimilated into the life in Mexico.
Roseanne Bacha Garza teaches at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. Thanks for telling us about this. I had no idea.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
In just a couple of minutes, the incredible Qawwali music of Pakistan's Sana Marvi. But first, a quick note. China is going all green and environmental again. First, there was the announcement that it's plowing $361 billion into renewable energy by 2020. Now Beijing has pledged to ban ivory sales by the end of this year. 70% of newly harvested ivory tusks from Africa end up in China. And with no democratic process to contend with, China got the ban going today. It shut down permanently almost half of its official ivory carving factories and shops. John Scanlon is the UN official in charge of protecting the globe's endangered species, and he was on hand to witness some of the closures in China.
It's going to stop the opportunity for laundering illegally sourced ivory through legal markets, and it's also sending a message that the value of ivory is going down, the risk of illegally trading in ivory is going up, so profit down, risk up, it's not a very good proposition for the criminal element who've been driving this illegal trade.
But there are other hurdles to ending Chinese demand. The ban does not apply to Hong Kong, where ivory sales are brisk, and it's thought that 90% of the customers come from the mainland. There's also a lively trade in ivory just beyond China, in Myanmar, Laos, and Vietnam, all to meet Chinese demand. Then there's the pesky internet, where the bulk of illegal buying and selling takes place. Tom Milliken heads the elephant program at the wildlife trade watchdog group Traffic. He's based in Africa, the source of the ivory. He welcomes the ban, but says illegal Chinese ivory traders are entrenched in Africa. He cites one recent incident.
A Chinese national who got on an Emirates flight at Harare International Airport, transited through Dubai, and then was arrested in Hong Kong, wearing purposely built clothing with lots of little pockets in which up to 20 kilos of processed ivory is hidden.
Milliken says China will have to get involved outside of its borders in order to halt the lucrative trade in ivory. Finally today, even though the U.S. has a long history of relations, up and down, with Pakistan, the country itself is still something of a mystery for many Americans. We know it's a Muslim-majority nation. Maybe less known is that it has a deep tradition of the Sufi mystics that goes back over 1,000 years. Some Pakistanis will tell you that that mysticism penetrates the soul of the entire country, even though it's fallen out of favor in the past 30 years in Pakistan with the arrival of more strains of Islam from the Middle East. This is the voice of Sanam Marvi. She's a Sufi kaval, a devotional singer. Kavalis are songs that often extend into half-hour musical meditations, soaring voices, and ultimately trance states for some of the people listening and dancing. Sanam Marvi is touring the U.S. right now. She was selected as one of the artists for this year's season of Center Stage, the State Department's project that tours performers from around the world here in the U.S. And before her Boston show, she stopped by our studios. We spoke to her through an interpreter. No, it's not unheard of for a woman to be a Qawwali singer, but it is rare. There's kind of Abida Parveen and you, and that's kind of it. Does that come with any stigma of its own?
अजीब सी बात नहीं है बस मुझे लगता है कि वहां पर हमारे पाकिस्तान में बहुत कम औरतें
Well it is unusual because women in Pakistan Sanam Marvi says don't have all the freedoms that they ought to have and because of that it's more difficult for them to come to the limelight but of course more women need to come into this field and I'd like to add that besides Abda Parveen and Sanam Marvi there are quite a few other women and girls who are doing this music, and some of them are very good, but they still haven't made it to the mainstream.
As somebody who has made it to the mainstream, what kind of responsibility is that for you, kind of representing all women in Pakistan?
जी मुझे बहुत बड़ी लगता है कि लोगों ने मुझे
She feels this as a great responsibility that she has been given, that she has been mandated with. To as a woman to spread this message and because she believes that it is a big responsibility she takes her work very seriously and works very hard.
Do you feel that it's kind of creating excitement among young women that they can be independent, they could be a singer or they could be anything?
Ji bahut koshish karti hain par ye hai ki unko
Of course, women feel empowered when they listen to her and Abda Parveen. But it's difficult for them, mostly because of their families, because mostly their families are conservative and they don't want their women to come into the performing arts or to come on screen or to be exposed to the whole of society. But some of these women have such beautiful voices that she says that her voice is nothing compared to theirs.
Really?
Yes.
She's being humble, of course.
I think she is. That was Pakistani Kaval Sanam Marvi speaking through her interpreter. Also joining them while they're in the States is journalist Madia Syed. She's based in Karachi and writes for the magazine and newspaper Dawn. If you are lucky to be in a city where Sanam Marvi and her ensemble are performing, we thought we'd give you a little context for how the concert might unfold if you were attending it in Pakistan. That's what I wanted Madia Syed to describe.
Well, it would be different and if you were to attend it in a village or if you were to attend in a city, it would be very different. If Sanam was performing in any of the major cities, it would be very similar to how she performs in the United States. You have an audience that is properly seated and they enjoy the show and they sing along with it as well. The difference would be that Sanam's entourage would be a lot bigger. What you did not see were her. She has a team of like backing vocalists behind her and clappers, professional clappers.
And if this concert were happening in the provinces of Pakistan,
villages, that would be in the shrines.
Yeah.
So in the shrines, people are a bit more expressive of their happiness or the fact that they're enjoying. So they might even stand up and dance. And there's something called what we call hal, is when a kavali is going on and on and on, and you're in a state of trance, and so people start to headbang. But apparently, they can't get out of that state. And so the kavals then have to, you know, sing faster and faster and faster until that person snaps out of it, that audience member snaps out of it. So that's something you would see as well.
That was journalist Madia Syed from Pakistan with a little primer on what to expect at an authentic kavali performance. We've got dates for Sanam Marvi's concerts at PRI.org. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.